Time again to check in with Elaine Leung this morning and find out about Bay Area traffic starting on Highway 4 in the East Bay.
To Antioch we go. We have two incidents there. Eastbound 4, the off-ramp to Contra Loma. It's a crash there, and also we have a vehicle facing the wrong direction and blocking the two left lanes right past G Street. So watch out. Traffic is building there. Bay Bridge lights remain on, just a bit heavy over the span into the city. Elaine Leung for KQED.
Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car to KQED is easy. We can arrange to have it picked up running or not in most cases and invest the funds back into our news coverage. Learn more at kqed.org/cars. For stories that shape our world, just go to kqed.org. We're updating by the minute to keep you informed on kqed.org and over the air on KQED FM San Francisco and KQEI FM North Highlands, Sacramento. Good morning, I'm Dave Freeman. It's 11 a.m.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
And I'm Asma Khalid. It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Israeli police are out in force today in Jerusalem as Israelis mark the anniversary of victory in the Six-Day War, which resulted in the effective annexation of East Jerusalem.
Also, Republicans are hoping to take control of the seat held by Montana Democrat John Tester this fall.
Montana is pretty dominated by Republicans, and increasingly so it's become harder and harder each time for him.
These stories, and you might think cooking Indian food is complicated and the ingredients hard to find, but recipes in the cookbook Amrikan use peanut butter and Bisquick.
The majority of Indian food is incredibly approachable, and with a handful of spices and a handful of ingredients, you can go a really far way.
The news is first.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Hunter Biden's ex-wife and ex-girlfriend have testified at his federal gun trial in Delaware, detailing the defendant's use of crack cocaine. The president's son is accused of illegally buying a firearm in 2018. The defense argues Hunter Biden's in recovery and that he's become the target of electioneer politics. Beyond politics, the case also highlights a national epidemic. A study published last month by Johns Hopkins University found one in three U.S. adults knows someone who has died of a drug overdose. For many respondents, it was a relative or a close friend. President Biden's in France, preparing to mark 80 years since the D-Day invasion along the coast of Normandy. Dozens of U.S. veterans who took part in the world's largest military invasion by sea are also there. Some are more than 100 years old. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports this is expected to be the last major anniversary attended by anyone who was there.
The students of Charlotteau Middle School in the town of Bayeux, right behind the landing beaches, have been preparing songs, poems, and presents for the 44 American veterans who made the trip to France and will visit their school. They're all around the age of 100. 14-year-old student Lilou Caillot says she can't wait to meet them. Living next to the Normandy beaches, we know the history, she says, and it's magical to see the real people who liberated us. There will be parades, parties, and reenactments all week along the Normandy coast. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Bayeux, Normandy.
Students in America's K-12 schools are still missing a lot of class, a trend the pandemic made much worse. And some of the kids missing the most school are also the youngest. Here's NPR's Corey Turner.
In California, one in three kindergartners missed at least 10% of the school year last year. And that's a problem, says Hetty Chang with Attendance Works.
Chronic absence in kindergarten is associated with not being as likely to read or count proficiently in third grade.
One district in Livingston, California, knows families are confused. If a child seems sick, when is it okay to send them anyway? So district nurse Lori Morgan tells them, meet me in the school parking lot.
99% of the time, they're well enough to stay. Yeah, they are.
Livingston's absenteeism rate was far below the state average. Corey Turner, NPR News.
A boil advisory remains in effect for portions of Atlanta, but crews have finished repairing a major water main break that cut off access to safe drinking water for days for many residents. City officials say they're keeping the boil advisory in place in the Midtown area out of an abundance of caution as water service gradually comes back online. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Stanford University officials say law enforcement officers have arrested 13 pro-Palestinian activists who barricaded themselves inside the office of Stanford's president this morning. Members of the group called Stanford for Palestine, calling for Stanford to divest from companies tied to Israel's military assault on Gaza. Stanford student Emily Williams speaks for the group.
They believe that Stanford has not acted in good faith or moved in the direction of divestment. And so their demands still remain the same, which are divestment from companies that are materially and or monetarily contributing to or working with the Zionist Israeli entity.
A Stanford representative describes the actions of the protesters as unlawful. The city of San Francisco is taking over a parking garage in Golden Gate Park. The 800-space Music Concourse Garage is currently owned by a nonprofit, but the city's Municipal Transportation Agency board voted yesterday to take over its management. It's part of a plan approved when the city closed JFK Drive in the park to vehicles, and residents raised concern about access. Rec and Parks, Sarah Madland.
This is actually an element of the Golden Gate Park Safety and Access Program, which was the program we put in place to support the opening of JFK to fully to pedestrians and bicyclists and so on.
The city plans to develop policies and set rates to increase access for residents with disabilities and lower income levels once an acquisition is completed later this year. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. And support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org and the listeners of KQED. Hot inland, while cooler at the coast today. Heat advisory in effect inland today and tomorrow evening. And then it starts to cool off. Temperatures moderating towards the latter part of the week.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California.
And I'm Asma Khalid in Boston. It's Here and Now. Today is the annual holiday in Israel known as Jerusalem Day. The day marks Israel's effective annexation of East Jerusalem after the Six-Day War in 1967. And this year, tensions are even higher than usual after 8 months of war in Gaza. Ahead of the march, Israeli youth harassed Palestinian shopkeepers and pushed around journalists in the Muslim quarter of the Old City. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf joins us now from Jerusalem. Kat, it's good to have you with us.
Hey, Asma.
So, Kat, you were out on the streets earlier today. Describe for us what you saw.
Yeah, so earlier before the march started, we were in the Old City in the Muslim Quarter, and we were just walking around. Shops were still kind of open, but some shopkeepers were closing up. But then, you know, groups of young Israelis, pretty much all teenage boys, came in and started to harass Palestinian shopkeepers. Some of them, you know, were giving Palestinians the middle finger, chanting things like wipe them out, talking about Palestinians. I saw one group had an Israeli flag and they were trying to force a Palestinian man to hang it up in his shop and he refused. We saw them push their way into shops, pull things off the shelves. They pushed a few journalists around and some were hurt. And, you know, the Israeli police were there and they did step in to break up these scuffles, you know, even going so far as to shoot off pepper spray to try and disperse everyone. But a lot of the shopkeepers we talked to said they didn't feel like the police were really there to protect them. Mm-hmm. There were also some leftist Israeli activists there. You know, they were doing their best to protect Palestinians, helping them walk through the crowd safely, holding the police accountable, things like that. So it was really a scene. And, you know, that was all before this big flag march began. Once the march started a few hours later, the streets had largely been cleared. You know, Palestinian shops were closed. Mm-hmm. Police and soldiers lined a lot of the streets.
Talk to us a little bit about the history here, because the legacy of the Six-Day War is still affecting the reality on the ground politically in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, at the time in 1967, Jordan controlled East Jerusalem and the West Bank. But during that Six-Day War, Israel seized both of those, you know, including control of the Western Wall, which is a key holy site to Judaism. You know, it's in the Old City in Jerusalem, and it's kind of the dividing point between the East and West Jerusalem. Most countries don't recognize Israel's claim to either East Jerusalem or the West Bank, and you know, Palestinians want those territories for their future state. And you know, you said it is still rippling out today. You know, it was also at this time that Israel seized control of the Gaza Strip, which was under Egypt's control before. So the 1967 war is really critical to what's happening now in the region.
I want to go back to one event you mentioned earlier, which is this flag march through the city. It's part of how the holiday is traditionally celebrated. It's an annual event where there are thousands of Israeli nationalists parading through the old city. What was the scene specifically around that march today?
Yeah, it is big. Around 20,000 people or so turned out. It's still happening right now outside where I am in Jerusalem. You know, the march's route winds its way from the western part of the city all the way through the Muslim quarter of the old city and ends at the Western Wall. And, you know, it's just waves and waves of people carrying Israeli flags, marching down the streets, just as far as the eye can see. And it's a very celebratory atmosphere, you know, but, you know, there are also a lot of hateful chants, a lot of, you know, hate speech toward Palestinians and Arabs. We heard people chanting things like death to Arabs in Hebrew. Another chant a large group was saying was burn all the villages, talking about Palestinian villages. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's also that layer to it. You know, I've been to this flag march before in 2021, and tensions were really high then. A ceasefire had just been declared to a different war in Gaza. And this felt pretty similar to that, although I will say Israelis I talked to this year told me that it felt really important for them to be out there now, to be showing unity after October 7th, you know, those attacks by Hamas, and to show that the city is theirs.
Before I let you go, Kat, I want to ask you about some signs that the conflict in the Middle East could be spreading beyond Gaza. There are reports that Hezbollah has been firing missiles into the Golan Heights from Lebanon. Israel's war cabinet met to discuss the worsening security along its northern border. What does this all mean?
Yeah, it's been getting worse and worse up on the north border. You know, just yesterday, firefighters were battling flames ignited by rockets launched by Hezbollah from Lebanon. You know, there were multiple fires started that spread really quickly, fueled by these strong winds and this hot, dry weather we're experiencing here. And then, you know, the Israeli military yesterday fired back. They retaliated with artillery fire and fighter jets. The Israeli military, when we asked them, when NPR asked them, says that Hezbollah fire has increased a lot in the past month and a half, and it says that the group has started targeting more populated cities in northern Israel. You know, Israel and Hezbollah have been fighting this low-grade war since Hezbollah fired at Israel when the Gaza war began last year after October 7th. And Israel just completed military exercises to prepare for another possible war. I'll also say that just last night, Israel's military chief said, quote, "We are approaching a decision point about an escalated war in the north." So it really is just what everyone here is kind of watching nervously, waiting to see what might happen.
All right. That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Jerusalem. Kat, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thanks, Asma.
President Biden's handling of Israel's war in Gaza and immigration are two of the hot-button issues in Montana, where a high-profile Senate race is taking shape. Three-term Democrat and farmer John Tester and Republican businessman Tom Sheehy easily won their primaries yesterday. The November election is considered a toss-up. Tester is the only Democrat holding statewide office in red state Montana, and Republicans say he's vulnerable. If Sheehy wins Tester's seat, Republicans could regain control in the narrowly divided Senate. Matthew Brown is the Rockies chief correspondent for the Associated Press, and he joins us now. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
So Montana, we said, is a red state, thought to be one that Trump will win. Yet there's a Democratic senator, John Tester, who's held the Senate seat for three terms. He easily won his primary. He's raised a ton of campaign cash. We're going to get to the Republican Tim Sheehy in a moment. But tell us about Tester's record thus far. Seems like the party base overwhelmingly satisfied with his job to date.
Yeah, Tester cruised to victory in the primary. He's got really strong support among Democrats in Montana, also among some independents, which has allowed him to squeeze out victories in each of his last three elections. As you said, Montana is pretty dominated by Republicans, and increasingly so. So it's become harder and harder each time for him.
Tester campaigning on the ways he's split from President Biden, particularly on immigration and border security. How so?
Well, he's been pushing Secretary Mayorkas, Defense Secretary Austin, during hearings to take a stronger stance on the border, to do more on the border. Immigration, like in much of the country, is a big issue in Montana. He's been distancing himself, Senator Tester, from the administration in hopes of looking tougher than the administration is.
So let's turn to the Republican primary now, where Tim Sheehy won easily. He campaigned pretty heavily on being tough on immigration. He wants the border wall built, Trump's border wall, that is. He's much less known, but he did win the endorsement of Donald Trump. And he got rich when he moved to Montana a decade ago and started an aerial firefighting company. Tell us a little more about him.
So he's a former Navy SEAL, biographical feature, which the Republicans like a lot. He is a businessman. He has not run for office before, though. He's a newcomer. He's had some stumbles along the way, but he's got strong backing from the Republicans, and he, too, cruised to victory last night in the primary.
Yeah, one of those stumblings is actually a Washington Post investigation into an incident in a state park that involved Sheehy and a gun going off. There are lingering questions about how the bullet ended up in his arm. Suffice to say, he admitted to lying. It didn't seem to dent him in this race. In fact, he blasted the media, which we know goes down well with the MAGA base. What's the reaction to this incident from other Republicans and those thinking about voting for him?
So I was talking with voters yesterday during the primary, and I talked to a man in Billings who is a veteran who was not voting for Sheehy because of the bullet incident, just found it distasteful. However, when I talked to him about the general election, if he would vote for Tester over Sheehy, he said no, that he would go with Sheehy for sure against Tester.
Interesting. And then, like other MAGA Republicans, Sheehy wants to cut government, particularly the Department of Education and the Department of Homeland Security. This is, he's pushing for tougher border policies. He's offered up for the replacement of the Department of Education a co-op homeschooling model that he uses for his own children. Are voters hearing these kinds of plans and the details, and is it resonating?
Well, the voters I've talked to seem focused on much broader issues, immigration, inflation, the economy. There's not much attention on the individual policy proposals from these two candidates as much as on the greater political wins.
Talking about foreign policy, Sheehy has been very critical of Biden's pullout from Afghanistan. He said that he and others gave up their 20s to help that country, and then Biden just ran out of the country. Yet he also echoes Trump's America First talk, which seems like a bit of a contradiction there. On the other side, protesters angry about the war in Gaza have made their voices heard at some of Democrat John Tester's events. I'm just wondering how foreign policy might play out in the November election.
Yeah, when Tester was confronted with Gaza protesters, he was very respectful to them, but made it clear that he disagrees with them and believes that strong support for Israel is where America should stay. Sheehy falls along the same lines. He criticizes Tester for not being strong enough on defense issues, but Tester has a lot of experience in that area too.
And where do you expect the campaign to go? We've said it's going to be very close. Do you think some of those who didn't vote for Sheehy might go over to Tester or vice versa?
There is a small group of voters that both campaigns will be campaigning very aggressively to get on their side. There's already been some $45 million spent on this election, and this is in Montana, state with barely more than a million people. There's another 125 plus million lined up to be spent between now and November. So there's going to be a lot of noise, and it's going to focus on a small number of people who have not yet decided.
Matthew Brown is the Rockies' chief correspondent for the Associated Press. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. For months, hospitals across Gaza have been shutting down as Israeli raids and evacuation orders push from north to south. And without access to medical care, children there are dying.
There is lack of food, lack of proper nutrition, proper medication. It unfortunately is not in our hands.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Hear that report on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear the report and more this afternoon at 1 and later today at 4:30 on KQED. Today on The World at 2 in Japan, there's an advertising campaign that makes doting fathers look cool. In a country where the population is shrinking rapidly, can the trend be reversed by getting dads more involved? That story, more global news, the latest at 2 on The World on KQED. Support for KQED comes from Symmetry, offering wealth management engineered for life in the Bay Area, celebrating 20 years of helping clients maximize opportunities like concentrated stock positions and RSUs. More at SUMMITRY.com. KQED's newest newsletter, The Sauce, is all about serving you the Bay Area's tasty trends and hidden food finds. You can sign up at kqed.org/newsletters to become a Bay Area food insider.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
It's Here and Now. A member of Ukraine's parliament now says that Ukraine has struck a military facility inside of Russia using American weapons. This comes just days after the Biden administration lifted its ban and began allowing Ukraine to shoot U.S. weapons inside Russian territory. Meanwhile, Ukraine has also been attacking Russia's oil refineries, but the U.S. has criticized those attacks, saying they could raise global energy prices. Let's learn more with Lauri Miliverta. He's a lead analyst at the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air. It's a research organization in Finland. He and his colleagues have written a piece in Foreign Affairs arguing that U.S. criticism is misguided and that Ukraine should keep striking Russian oil refineries. He joins us now from Helsinki. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Before we get to the United States criticism, I want you to give us a synopsis of what the current environment is like. You and your colleagues report that Ukraine has launched at least 20 strikes on Russian refineries since October. Can you explain what's the goal of these attacks?
The Ukraine has both military goals attached to this and economic goals. So Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Russia's military is largely funded by income from exports of oil. And therefore, attacking oil refineries serves economic goals. Clearly, it also serves military goals in broadening the range of targets that Ukraine can attack in Russia. And refineries make nice targets because obviously oil is flammable. So with a fairly small payload of a drone, if you manage to set off an oil fire, you can do a lot of damage.
I want to ask you about the Biden administration's criticism of Ukraine's attacks on Russian oil refineries. And in fact, let's hear a clip of tape from the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Here he is speaking to the Senate Armed Services Committee back in April.
Certainly, those attacks could have a knock-on effect in terms of the global energy situation. But quite frankly, I think Ukraine is better served in going after tactical and operational targets that can directly influence the current fight.
What do you make of this criticism from the White House, from the administration here in the United States?
Certainly the fear of affecting global oil prices or energy prices hasn't been realized. Russia was forced to shift from exporting refined products to crude oil that reduced the revenue that they were able to generate, and that was most definitely a good thing. I think from military perspective, having a broader range of targets that you can strike and that will hurt Russia when you strike them just makes it more feasible to execute those strikes. It spreads Russia's air defenses thinner.
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. I mean, it sounds like fundamentally you think the U.S. criticism, though, is misguided.
Absolutely. the fear that global oil prices would rise is based on the idea that if Russia is forced to sell at a lower price, they will cut output.
Okay.
That's how things work with the US oil industry. Because it's profit-driven, it has fairly high production costs, but that's not how it works with Russia. If you look historically, over a long time period, there's no correlation between global oil prices and Russia's output. So Russia's oil industry is an extension of the Kremlin. Its purpose is to generate tax revenue for the Kremlin. It has low production costs. So when the prices that they see go down, they will keep producing and might even produce more to hit revenue targets.
Mm. You're right that as of the end of March, Ukraine had destroyed 14% of Russia's oil refining capacity. But the wire service Reuters is also reporting that Russia has been able to quickly repair the damage in many cases. So what has been the overall impact on Russia?
When the impact of the strikes was at its peak, Russia was forced to export more crude oil into the global market and less refined oil products. This means that Russia was making less money on the exports and lost bargaining power because there are only very few countries that you can export crude oil to from Russia, whereas refined oil products you can sell just about anywhere. So the effect was to lower the price that Russia can fetch for its oil and therefore reduce the revenue that the country had is able to channel to its military.
Hmm.
On the global market, the effect was negligible. So there was no jump in the prices of refined oil products, which is what, as a consumer, you would care about because that's what you put in your tank, obviously.
I want to ask you also about what the energy environment is like inside of Ukraine. There are certainly a number of reports that Russia has been continuing to target Ukraine's energy infrastructure. There are reports of blackouts across Ukraine after power plants were struck. What do these attacks mean for Ukraine?
Russia's been striking Ukrainian civil infrastructure from the very beginning of the invasion, including refineries, but especially power plants. This has meant at times blackouts and power shortages. Amazingly, Ukraine's companies and government have managed to keep the lights on in most of the country most of the time. The most recent very severe situation happened when the U.S. military aid to Ukraine was on hold and the country was running low on air defenses. The next period of great danger will be next winter, of course, again, so it's essential that the aid from the U.S. and other Ukraine's allies continues to make sure that Ukraine is able to defend itself.
Lauri Milaverta is the lead analyst at the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
An energy story from this country now. Nearly 17,000 homes on tribal lands don't have electricity. The Department of Energy's Office of Indian Energy reports most of them are in Alaska and the Southwest. The Biden administration has announced more federal funding to electrify those homes, and getting electricity is life-changing for families. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrorazio reports from the Navajo Nation Reservation.
In the sparsely populated Navajo town called Cornfields, herds of free-range sheep dash around a remote home site. It's an arid land not too far from the Arizona-New Mexico border.
Dogs, horses, cows, you name it, you run into everything.
Mark Sinicki is with the Salt River Project, a nonprofit utility company. He's overseeing a volunteer crew of diggers and line workers. They're one of dozens of utility crews who travel between now and July to donate their time to bring electricity to these communities.
The joy I get is seeing their face when they turn that light switch on. That's why I'm here.
And today, after 7 long years in the dark, it's Jerome Shirley's turn to experience that. He smiles as he flips a light switch on in his home for the first time.
I want to be able to bring my kids back out here and make something of it.
Shirley grew up without any power, so this is a dream come true. After a difficult divorce and overcoming homelessness, he says he's always wanted to create a welcoming space suitable for his children. Shirley also wants to enjoy his home for himself in retirement.
I'm glad this is hooked up so I can do the things I need to do.
5 miles away is Jerry Chi, who grew up in the neighboring community of Ganado, unmistakably renowned for its bold red-hued rugs.
My mother was a weaver, one of the master weavers, and I'm the only person that relearned.
Inside Chi's cozy modular home, the Navajo language radio station KTNN is on. He sits next to a handmade loom with a partially finished pattern. Without a steady light source, it's virtually impossible to weave.
The only thing I do at night is I sit there and I spin the yarn.
But now,
I'm going to have to find me a lampstand or something, you know, so that I can do this.
She also remembers a childhood without power.
So we had to use kerosene. Until about ninth grade, that's when I went to Tube City. And that's where electricity, running water was all introduced.
He lived in Phoenix for 4 decades, but decided to move here in 2022. He hauled his house with him and has been waiting for electricity ever since. Buying groceries is a daily burden. Chi stores what little he can inside ice chests while cooking indoors with a propane stove. Despite owning a solar panel, it doesn't generate enough energy for all of his needs. But now he finally has electric power.
It's been a long time coming. Oh my God, I'm happy. Oh my God, all my worries are gone.
But another 13,000 households are still waiting in the dark, and Walter Haas says a $10 million grant from President Biden's Tribal Electrification Program will help.
I feel we've got a little bit of breathing room.
Haas is the general manager for the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority. 5 years ago, it partnered with the American Public Power Association to launch Light Up Navajo, an annual effort to bring electricity to Navajo families. More than 250 volunteers from 16 states are expected to help out in the coming month. Haas says it costs them up to $50,000 to wire and connect a home on the Navajo Nation, but with the drastic change in costs of materials.
We used to say $1 billion for 18,000 homes. We're at $1 billion for 13,000 homes.
Almost 40% of Navajo household incomes are below the federal poverty threshold, so affording it on their own is simply out of reach. Without Light Up Navajo, Haas estimates that it would take half a century to electrify all homes across the sprawling 27,000 square miles. No more than 500 homes are getting power through this mutual aid project. Haas says their goal is to double it.
And that would get us to 15 to 18 years. Still a long way from where we should be, you know, in the United States today, but a heck of a lot better than 50 years.
Electrifying the largest reservation in the U.S. is still a massive undertaking, largely due to geography. In the meantime, Light Up Navajo volunteers will keep traveling to this remote region in the Southwest to help them flip the switch, one home at a time. For Here and Now, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio on the Navajo Nation.
And we are with you here and now.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Steve Brown. Hunter Biden's ex-wife has been called to testify in his federal gun trial as prosecutors seek to show the depths of his drug problem, which they say was still going on when he filled out a form to buy a firearm. His ex-girlfriend was also called to the stand. Testimony began with an FBI agent whose key role in the trial was to establish that Hunter Biden had a drug problem when he purchased the gun in October of 2018. President Biden is headed to France for the 80th anniversary of D-Day, where he'll join other world leaders to commemorate the invasion that helped bring an end to World War II. He arrives at a time when the Western alliances that were forged in that era are being threatened in the United States and overseas. Some allies fear Donald Trump threatens to upend American commitments if he wins another term in the White House this year. The European Union's climate service says last month marked the hottest May ever, capping 12 straight months of average monthly temperature records amid high and rising concerns about global warming. The EU's climate change service cited an average surface air temperature of 15.9 degrees Celsius last month. That's almost 61 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than the estimated May average before industrial times. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from UC Santa Cruz, where researchers discovered how often sea otters, a threatened species, use tools when feeding to survive in a rapidly changing environment. More at ucsc.edu. Hassler Heating and AC, advancing California's electric initiatives by converting homes to heat pump technology. For installation or repair of heating and cooling equipment, visit hasslerheating.com. Maybe you're inside in the AC. Maybe you're outside. Take care if you're outdoors. Warm to hot weather the rest of today around the Bay Area, Sacramento Valley. Near the water, there's a beach hazard statement for high surf along the coast. Look for highs near the water in the 70s up to the low 100s far inland today. Very hot, excessive heat warning in the Sacramento Valley with today's highs 100 to 105.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And Luma Sales, working to fulfill the investment needs of institutional and retail clients worldwide by integrating proprietary research and risk analysis to develop a customized approach for each investor. LumaSales.com.
It's Here and Now. There's a new Banksy Museum in New York City, except the works there aren't actually Banksy's. And the British graffiti artist and political activist, whose real name is not known, never agreed to having his work reproduced. Which means it's all very complicated. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento reports.
The museum tries to recreate the experience of being on the street. There's manhole covers, fake debris, and everywhere are walls. They look like brick or concrete, and on them stencils of rats, children, police officers.
Banksy changed the rules. If you want to organize something about Banksy, you have to change the rules also.
That's museum founder Aziz Bardar, who privately collects Banksy originals and opened an exhibit in Paris several years ago. When that version was successful, he opened this branch in New York. He describes Banksy as a pirate. For decades, the anonymous British artist has upended the art world, stenciling big murals that are often funny and political and appear suddenly overnight. Vardar says he's on a similar wavelength by
creating a museum of someone without the authorization of the artist.
He sees what he's doing as a kind of preservation of Banksy's works for the sake of the public. Out in the world, he says they're often painted over, damaged by weather, or
sometimes the cleaning team of the city, they just clean it in the morning. It happens.
But Leila Amina Dole, an art and intellectual property attorney in New York City, has a different take.
There are tons of replicas of the Mona Lisa, and that's not preserving the original, and I would argue the same for Banksy.
A lot of Banksy's pieces are site-specific works. They're made at a particular location, like the West Bank Barrier Wall, with a particular context in mind. She says taking that art indoors and charging a $30 entrance fee goes against Banksy's core mission.
It's not about the hype. It's not about the money.
That's Banksy speaking through a heavy audio distortion filter in his award-winning 2010 documentary, Exit Through the Gift Shop. It criticized the commercialization of street art, and Pest Control, the company that manages Banksy's licensing, has also denounced any use of his work for profit on its website. Pest Control and Banksy did not reply to requests for comment. We do know that Banksy has written that copywriting is for losers. But Amina Dole says
he automatically had a copyright when he created this artwork. The fact that he doesn't like copyright doesn't really make a difference.
Vardar doesn't seem too worried, either about selling tickets or Banksy t-shirts in the museum's gift shop.
We exist. If Banksy wants to sue us, it's very easy.
Amina Dole says Banksy's not likely to sue anytime soon. It would risk his anonymity and ruin the mystique surrounding him. She says that could impact the value of his work. Not everyone agrees with her. Terry Morris is from Florida and recently visited the Banksy Museum. She has another word for Banksy's decision to keep his identity private.
Coward.
She says she enjoys Banksy's art, but she's almost irritated that he's not involved with the museum.
The ironic part is everybody else is making money off it. And think of the things he could do with the money he could have made off his own art to fix or change these things that he finds so appalling.
For now, no lawsuit means the Banksy Museum can keep its doors open for as long as people show up. But those visitors won't include people like the founders of Brooklyn Street Art, which documents and preserves street art. They say these Banksys, they're not the real thing. Over email, they said this was more like a traveling circus than a museum, and likened the replicas to Michelangelo's on the walls of a pizza parlor. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News, New York.
Do you know why you got feelings in your heart?
You're listening to Here and Now.
Healthcare is a top priority for voters in the upcoming election.
It's important to note that Latinos have essentially had the lowest access to both health insurance and healthcare among any racial and ethnic group in the country over the last 10 years or so.
Our series, We the Voters, continues with a focus on healthcare and the uninsured on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Catch it tomorrow morning starting at 2 a.m. on KQED. Coming up today at 4, it's Marketplace. Seasonal adjustment. It's one of those terms that's attached to economic data all the time, whether it's related to prices, jobs, or rates. This afternoon, a look at what this term actually means and how it's calculated. That story and the rest of the day's financial news on Marketplace at 4 today. Support for KQED comes from the San Francisco SPCA, where adoption fees are waived on animals 5 months and older through June. Listeners can find a furry new friend at the Adoption Center at 250 Florida or sfspca.org. And Xfinity, with their Wi-Fi Boost Pod, in-home wall-to-wall Wi-Fi offers coverage throughout the home. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station, and from TimberTech, sustainable decking materials with no staining or resurfacing needed, a range of products including furniture, porch boards, outdoor lighting, and accessories. More at TimberTech.com. And Road Scholar, a not-for-profit educational travel organization offering adventures for adults in more than 100 countries. Learn more at roadscholar.org/explore.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid in Boston.
And I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. It's Here and Now. Okay, so for this next segment, I first had to make a cup of tea. Well, masala chai, actually, because it's a cookbook that really speaks to me. It's by LA journalist and food writer Khushbu Shah, and it contains recipes for Indian dishes that incorporate ingredients like peanut butter, ketchup, and, wait for it, even Bisquick. Because, as Shah writes, Indians who came to the U.S. wanted to taste the foods of home, and they often had to improvise when it came to ingredients. They also adapted American dishes to incorporate Indian flavors. Her book is called American, a play on the word America, said, of course, the way Indians would. And Khushbu Shah joins us now to talk about it. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
You know, I really related to this book, Khushbu, because I was born in India. My family migrated to Australia in the 70s. And, you know, I watched my mom and aunties conjure miracle Indian meals from make-do ingredients available in Australia. But Bisquick and peanut butter, not really Aussie staples, so they weren't in our pantry. Tell me how your mother used these ingredients in her cooking.
We always had Bisquick in the pantry, not to make biscuits, which is, you know, the recipe that's on the back of the box.
Right.
She would occasionally use it to make pancakes, but again, would not follow the recipe on the box. And then really what she kept it on hand for was to make like perfect tender gulab jamun, actually.
It's just an Indian dessert, a little ball of yumminess, which is fried and then soaked in like a sweet rose syrup.
Absolutely, yes. And then the peanut butter is actually one of my staples. I don't always keep the roasted peanuts on hand that my mom uses to make different chutneys and things, but I always have a jar of peanut butter in my fridge. So I just chuck that in the blender when I'm making a chutney.
It's generational, what you're talking about here. Your parents were the immigrants. They struggled without all their Indian ingredients, and it's trickled down to you. Tell me how you adapt in your kitchen in addition to peanut butter.
Obviously, we have way more access thanks to the proliferation of Indian grocery stores or more international grocery stores. But I also grew up eating very globally. My pantry is very global. Like, just as much as like curry leaves have a home, so does like gochujang, so does sriracha, so does soy sauce, so does cream cheese. And these are ingredients that I'm really comfortable with also. So I've adapted a lot of Indian dishes to include ingredients that I always have on hand. Like, I always make my chili cheese toast, which is an Indian dish that has shredded cheese, chopped masala, diced bell peppers, onions, and serrano peppers, usually tossed together and melted on bread. But I adapt it with, you know, a layer of whipped cream cheese because I think it just adds a really nice silky creaminess to the dish. I also use pickled jalapenos. And then instead of kind of the classic thin white sandwich bread that you would maybe use in India to make chili cheese toast, I always actually use like a Japanese milk bread or shokupan because I just love the fluffy texture and I think it makes for an excellent chili cheese toast base.
my mouth is watering. You know, I really appreciated that in addition to the fact that you can use all these other ingredients, you did have a list of these three must-have Indian ingredients, and that's Kashmiri chili powder, kasuri methi, and curry leaves. Tell me why these three ingredients.
Curry leaves, I just, you know, they are irreplaceable. You know, they're optional in a lot of recipes, but when you add it to the recipe, it takes it to a new height, a new depth. Mm-hmm. The scent of curry leaves alone are spectacular. While they are optional, you know, they do make every dish better, quite frankly. And your house and your kitchen will just be better for having curry leaves. And then as far as Kashmiri red chili pepper goes, Kashmiri red chili pepper just has this milder heat to it, but it's still a little bit spicier than paprika, but it's not quite as hot as cayenne. And it also just has its own really wonderful like aroma to it that flavor. Exactly. It's more than just heat. And so I find that is really important in a lot of dishes.
And I wanted to ask you, because as a South Indian, I would add coconut and, and maybe ur dal or besan to the list, which is a chickpea flour, which reminds me that Indian cooking is so regional. And, you know, in South India, we have an abundance of coconut trees, so that gets used a lot. But you talk in the book really interestingly about how Indian food in America mirrors the waves of immigration, where people came from in India. Tell us why Americans know more about North Indian food, or when they think of Indian food, they're probably eating food that's more North Indian.
Yes. I mean, when you look at the initial waves of immigration into the U.S., it was mostly STEM professionals or people chasing those professional degrees that came from often Punjab or Gujarat. And so those are states of India that are more in the north. They brought their culinary legacies and traditions. And then also, you know, a lot of Indian food in America is also still via England. A lot of the curry house classics as well, which tend to also... Yes, exactly. Be reminiscent of a lot of North Indian and namely Punjabi dishes. Yes.
Yeah. So one of the things I also really found fascinating is that I feel like your cookbook is speaking to what I might loosely term a diaspora generation. You and I, our parents, and definitely our grandparents, traditionalists. You know, my grandparents would probably be horrified at some of the things that I do, you know, and I was thinking when your maple sea salt dosa or your garlic bread dosa, oh my gosh, I love them, but my grandmother would probably be horrified. My children love it. And here then we are, I'm going to guess here, Kushbu, you and me, we sit in the middle. We can go both ways, like a hybrid cuisine version. And I'm just wondering, what's this going to do to Indian cuisine in the diaspora? Because I feel like our kids and maybe their kids, it's going to keep going in this hybrid mashup mix-up version, right? What's going to happen to traditional Indian food?
I think traditions are always meant to evolve. Cuisines are always meant to evolve. I think even if you look at Indian food in India today, it looks so different than it did 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But there's also certain dishes, you know, even in this book, they are the same as they are in India. You know, we cook them the same way here. They remain that way, like a great sambar. You know, a great classic sambar is just excellent as it is. And, it, you know, a great khichdi, which is a mashup of lentils and rice, like cooked together, remains pretty traditional here as it's cooked in India. And I think the ones that are just such staples are going to remain staples.
Can I make a secret confession? Well, not so secret, I guess. I make khichdi the way Italians make risotto. And I make it with risotto rice because I love the khichdi texture. My grandmother would roll in her grave if she heard that I was doing that. But nonetheless, my family love it. It's a winner over
here.
That
sounds brilliant.
Well, you have so many other brilliant ones in this book, like the way you do cheesy corn pizza and Bombay masala toast. I love your incorporation of Indian street foods, chaat, which really is so little known here in the U.S. outside of the Indian community. I feel like in a way it's maybe an introduction to a bigger audience. Was that part of your goal there?
Oh, absolutely. As much as I want fellow South Asians to like see themselves in the pages of this book, I want everyone to see themselves in the pages of this book or feel really comfortable making this. I think there's this notion in the West that Indian food in particular is like very complicated and unapproachable and like, you know, requires a million spices and hours and hours and hours of time. But that's very much not the case. Yes, there are certain dishes that fall into those categories, but the majority of Indian food is incredibly approachable. And with a handful of spices, you know, and a handful of ingredients, you can go a really far way. And I wanted to show that.
So end for us, Khushbu, with one recipe for someone maybe who's never tried to cook Indian food. What's one that they might find easy enough and delicious?
I think this is maybe the most underrated recipe in my book. It's called cabbage nushak. It's literally a stir-fried cabbage dish. It's my favorite weeknight recipe when I really don't know what to feed myself. It's quite literally shredded cabbage, stir-fried with some Kashmiri red chili powder, a little turmeric, a little salt, a little oil. I like to put it over rice with some yogurt. It hits all the notes. It's comforting. It's delicious, but it also takes maybe 5 minutes.
I love
and it. It's one of my favorite things. Yes.
Khushbu Shah's new cookbook is Amrikan, 125 recipes from the Indian American diaspora. Khushbu, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Coming up next hour on Here and Now, a conversation about San Francisco's Chinatown. In Orphan Bachelors, Fabian Ng writes about her family and the elderly men who populated San Francisco's Chinatown when she was growing up. All felt the impact of the Chinese Act of 1882. The conversation with the author next hour. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car is easy. We can arrange to have it picked up running or not in most cases and invest the funds back into our news coverage. Or at kqed.org/cars. KQED Live presents an evening of reliving the disco era's explosion in the Bay Area and a preview of the new PBS series Disco, Soundtrack of a Revolution. That's June 6th. kqed.org/live, supported by Comcast Business.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And WBUR with ZSP Media, presenting Beyond All Repair, a new crime podcast that will leave you questioning everything. When family betrays family, who do you believe? Listen everywhere.
It's Here and Now. The Washington Post is in the middle of a major editorial shakeup, in theory, to help save the paper from a serious financial shortfall. Earlier this week, the paper's CEO and publisher, Will Lewis, forced out the paper's top editor, Sally Busby, effective immediately. Now he's bringing in two new leaders, his former colleagues at The Wall Street Journal and The Daily Telegraph, a long-running conservative-leaning British newspaper. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is following this story, and he joins us now. Thanks for coming on, David.
Pleasure.
So Sally Busby had served as executive editor of the Post since 2021. You know, frankly, David, in the sort of longevity of newspaper editors, that is not that long. So why did the CEO force her out?
Well, he himself was appointed late last year and took over
the beginning of this year. He just announced in recent weeks new priorities for the paper, new planks for the paper, and he wanted somebody on board. But a lot of it also had to do with the fact he was going to be splitting up the authority of the executive editor into two jobs, and she didn't really want her authority to be bifurcated in that way.
Mm. So talk to us a little bit more about this new structure. I mean, my understanding is that the CEO publisher is unveiling this totally new structure for the newsroom that, again, in theory, is supposed to improve the post-financial woes.
Sure. The publisher in question, he's also the chief executive of the Post, is Will Lewis. He came to the Post from having done a stint as the publisher of the Wall Street Journal and CEO of its parent corporate division, owned and controlled by Rupert Murdoch. And he was well regarded there. He came here and he's creating what he's calling a third newsroom. The first one is the conventional newsroom. You cover news, and politics, and sports and things like that. The second one is already existing as well as the opinion section. Mm-hmm. The third one, he says, is really in some ways from the cheap seats, it looks a little bit like a hodgepodge, but the idea is to be the innovative section of the editorial content. He's going to try to figure out ways to do new kinds of coverage for the Post, but not indigenous to Post platforms. What does that mean? Well, maybe as an example, videos on TikTok and other social media platforms, which isn't to say that the Post isn't already doing that, but to perhaps do it in a more focused way. And the second editor who's going to be parallel to the editor-in-chief is going to oversee these things.
Okay, so talk to us a little bit more about these two newsroom leaders who are being brought in. Who are they exactly?
Well, and this is where things get pretty interesting. For the next 6 months, because it was basically became activated on Sunday night when all of this was announced to the great shock of the staff, the new editor of the newsroom is going to be Matt Murray. He's the former editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal, was well-regarded there, a somewhat conventional newsman in the lingo of our industry, but very well-regarded. And then after Election Day, effectively, he's going to move on to be the head of this third newsroom. Then what you're going to see is one of Will Lewis's former colleagues from the Daily Telegraph, as you mentioned, a guy named Rob Winnett, is going to come over here, and he'll be the editor of the conventional newsroom. Why is there going to be this weird delay and echo? Well, first off, the Telegraph and its competitors in Britain are overseeing a major British political race. The Prime Minister has announced snap elections for July. And of course, we've got this major presidential race. And it strikes me that asking a British journalist who's never worked in these parts to lead a newsroom of the Washington Post to cover that election is a little bit like asking a guy to learn how to kayak in tsunami. It's just a bit too much, right?
How is the staff at the Post feeling about these changes?
Well, I was able to listen in on a staff meeting that occurred Monday when Will Lewis introduced Murray, although not Winnett, to the staff. And let me just say, Matt Murray was barely able to get in a word about his interest and his excitement about the job. The staff really pushed back. They were shocked. Sally Busby was not necessarily widely loved, but she was respected. She was the first female editor of the Post, and she was essentially dumped in a press release and a staff memo late on a Sunday night without any warning, without anybody knowing that this job was going to be open. It appeared as though, and is the case, that Lewis pulled in two people that he had worked with closely. He had been the one to elevate Matt Murray to the editor-in-chief job at the Wall Street Journal when Lewis was publisher there, and he had worked closely with Rob Winnett at the Daily Telegraph on perhaps their signature scoop back in 2009.
Yeah. David, before we let you go, I do have to ask why folks ought to care about these kind of inner workings and maybe palace intrigue of what's going on at a newspaper based in Washington, D.C., right? We may read the Post, but a lot of folks don't read the Post. And why does this matter, if it does matter, beyond, you know, what's going on specifically within the halls of this newspaper?
Well, I think there are two reasons to care, one of which is the Post in and of itself is important. It's a bellwether institution. It helps to hold people accountable. It broke a lot of news over the past 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, and it really is one of our great guardians of watchdog journalism, and it's in financial trouble. It's owned by one of the world's richest people, Jeff Bezos, but it lost $77 million last year, according to Will Lewis, and he says its audience has been halved digitally. They have to find a way to make it financially sustainable. And secondly, that implies the second half, which is this is a challenge for all of journalism. You know, they laid off and bought out about 13% of their staff, but there have been a lot of that through the industry, including our own network. And I think all Americans should have a stake in whether or not major news organizations and local ones find a path forward to keep serving them in the way that we all try.
All right. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks so much.
You bet.
And we should note that the Washington Post is an editorial partner of Here and Now, but we cover them as we do other media organizations. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Asma Khalid in Boston.
I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. There's more news ahead. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station, and from the Music Emporium, guitar sellers for more than 50 years, celebrating the enduring presence of music made on the front porch and center stage. You can learn more at themusicemporium.com.
Here's a reminder to keep KQED on throughout the day for constant reliable newscasts bringing you news as it happens. KQED News ahead starting at 12:04. There are more stories ahead at KQED.org, too. CalMatters looks into AI use in the classroom. Teachers are using AI to grade papers, but who's evaluating the AI? Find that story, all of our news coverage, digitally, too, KQED.org. Here and Now, coming up,